fantastic.
Mm-hmm. My mom sent me a picture, and I still have it on my phone somewhere, because it brings me joy.
Mm-hmm. It's really great.
Anesthesia's a weird, weird thing. It does weird things to you.
You know what's really great?
What?
I hit record just as soon as you said, sent me a picture of it, and we didn't hear anything before that.
Oh.
So the people listening to this have no idea what you're referencing. Part you know of what? Me We're going to keep it that way.
I was going to say, part of me is tempted to say what, but also...
No.
It's a mystery. No. It's going to be a mystery. You don't get to know...
You don't get to know...
What I got sent a
That's
picture
for
of.
Us in this room.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just know, anesthesia's weird.
It is. And that just
anesthesia is very weird.
That just giant deepens the mystery, I think.
I feel like when I got my tonsils removed, when I came to, I was hitting on the doctor or the nurse that was like tending, not in an obvious way because I wasn't out yet.
Uh huh.
But I was being real friendly and complimentary, and my mom was in the room, and I feel like she picked up on it a little bit.
Yeah. Oh well,
probably.
You know, hey.
I don't know if that actually happened, but I feel like it happened.
That sounds good.
Anesthesia is a hell of a drug.
Yes, it is. So,
hell of a drug's mixed in anyway to make.
Well, anesthesia. Fucking A. Welcome to Ghosts and Hoes.
Ghosts and Hers.
Herpy Derp.
Ghosts and Hoes. Yes. Paranormal podcast where we talk about all things spoopy.
Yeah. Getting spooped.
Yeah. Cryptids a lot lately.
Yeah.
Aliens.
Mm hmm.
Motherfucking witchcraft.
Yeah.
Murder most motherfucking foul.
Definitely.
And that one time, haunted bunk beds.
Oh, yeah. So good. So just, is it weird that the haunted bunk beds are my happy place?
No.
Okay. I wouldn't have cared if it had been, but I just, you know.
No.
It's like when people are like, go to your mind palace, go to your happy place. I'm like, it's the haunted bunk beds.
Mind palace. Yep. Good Lord.
Sherlock.
That cup in black is the thing I saw today that I need.
Well, now I have a mighty need.
Wait, is that it? Is that the? Let me see it. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Solid black, and she's lovely.
Oh.
I'm still munching on the hot fries from last week.
Those ones are nice. Good.
Yeah. Nice.
Are they the mustard?
Yeah. Nice. The other ones I put down almost immediately. Yeah.
I couldn't find the mustard ones when I went to the Target the other day. More? I'm good, thank you.
I do.
But I did find the queso ones, which was what I was after anyway, so it was fine.
Queso.
They were good.
I've been running around today, and then I had to work for a minute, so I haven't eaten for quite some time.
How many hairs did you cut?
None. I did some extensions today.
Oh, nice. Okay.
On a client that's leaving town for spring break, and I couldn't get her anywhere else. So.
Spring break, woo!
Spring break 99!
Do you have any backhoes?
Always. Always.
Most of the time, yeah.
Yeah. More often than not. Mm-hmm. More often than not. First of all.
Yes?
Thank you. To Mindy for emailing all of your pets with human names to us.
Oh.
I just need you to tell them all that I love them, and they're all perfect. That's it. They're great. There's a rooster, I believe, named Derek, which is just fucking incredible. And again, thank you for sending those. They're just so good.
A rooster named Derek. I like that.
Yeah, it's great. And I just am tickled at the fact that that is a thing that happened. Then, this one is a bummer.
Uh-oh.
Rest in peace to Eric Carmen of All By Myself fame.
Singer. The song?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, he passed.
Rip.
Also, great song, Make Me Lose Control. Love that song. Oh,
rip.
You were great. And then Shigeichi Nagishi, the inventor of karaoke, passed away at 100 years old.
Rip.
Which.
Karaoke.
Sad, but also thank you for all that you did for parties.
For parties and
in the
fun.
Last 100 years.
And fun.
Yes. Today, the day we are recording.
On this day.
The 18th of March.
The day of our Lord.
Happy birthday to Brad Dorf.
Happy birthday.
No fucking way.
Yeah, he is 74 today.
Hell yeah.
And
I fucking love that man so much.
Literally and metaphorically killing it to this very day. You're welcome.
I love Brad Dorf so much.
He is great. I will never not be slightly unnerved by the fact that his daughter looks exactly like him.
To the point where she plays him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So.
the voice of Chucky.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. I mean, you say, okay, but...
Sure.
What you need to know...
About
Brad Dourif is that aside from being the voice of Chucky, he is one of the most criminally underrated actors that has ever lived.
He's really underrated.
He is so unbelievably fucking skilled. Mm-hmm. He plays like the main possessed dude in The Exorcist 3 mm-hmm. and is just like transformatively terrifying.
Yeah, he's real, real, real talented.
He also plays the young dude in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And he's very, very good.
Oh, that guy!
I believe the character's name is Boromir in Lord of the Rings. No, that's Sean Bean's character. In Lord of the Rings, there's a king that's like all decrepit and old.
Yeah.
And the evil guy that talks over his shoulder is Brad Dourif.
Yeah, that's exactly him. Yeah. Oh, I know exactly who that is.
Brad Dourif is amazing.
Yeah. I mean,
no one knows who he is.
In addition to having a voice that's easily recognizable, when you see his face, you're like, oh, I've seen him in literally thousands of things that I cannot place a single one at the moment.
Criminally underrated.
So good. Love you. Happy birthday, Brad. I know you're listening.
If you are, I'm mad that you haven't reached out yet.
Right? How dare.
I just want to meet you.
Our listener, Cammy, commented on the Manson Patroon episode. Mm-hmm. And said, this was a tough one. Thank you for your amazing research, effort, and delivery. I hope Manson has people shitting all over his freezer in hell.
Thanks, babes.
Which, 100%, we agree.
Hundo P.
Hundo P. Yes. Hundo P-P's.
Oh, there's another guy who died.
Who?
That's too many.
Let me make sure it's of the time.
Too many P-P's.
It's 99 too many for me.
It is 99 too many.
Well, this was updated today. So, another guy who died. No one's going to fucking know who this is. His name is David Seidler or Seidler.
No. I almost put that down.
Oh, yeah?
But I didn't because I figured no one would know.
No one's going to know.
But anyway, continue.
The most famous thing that he is recently known for is writing The King's Speech.
All right.
But he was a writer. He wrote a bunch of West End productions and movies, and he is very, very, very skilled.
Well, he's dead now, but he was skilled.
He is dead now.
Was skilled.
His work
had mad skills.
His work will live on.
His work will indeed
live on. Twill.
And then snacks.
Yay!
We have snacks. Oh boy.
Yeah. One. There was no other size for me to get those in. They just were like, hey, do you want a giant bag of these? No, sure, I guess.
They better be good.
I guess. Do you want... I'm trying to decide which one first. I feel like this one first.
Okay. Are you going to tell us?
These ones I'll tell you what these ones are.
Turtle chips.
They're called turtle chips because they look like turtle shells, but they're chocolate churro flavored.
Oh, okay.
And I was like, well, that... just seems fun all around.
Sure.
Now if I can open it is another story.
That is another.
I got scissors back here if it proves.
Another question. Oh.
Please don't explode them.
Boy.
I might need scissors.
Can you put that right up against the mic now? Yeah.
Good God.
This one is like... literally.
Well, it would be safer for you to toss me the bag.
Yeah, that's a better idea.
Good catch. Good catch.
I love these.
I have never had them.
I've had something very similar.
All right. Well,
they're very tasty. I'm going to devour this entire bag.
Please do.
Tasty. Look at how easily the scissors do that job.
It's almost like they're meant for it.
Almost.
Touché.
Almost just like that.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to smell.
Do it.
Oh,
Jesus. That actually smells fucking good.
Yeah, no, these are delicious.
And I'm not a sweets person, but that smells delightful.
It's like, stop huffing the bag and hand them over. Ooh.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, these are going to be wonderful.
This one.
All right.
You ready?
Yeah.
3, 2, 1, go.
Ooh.
Son of a bitch.
They remind me of Buñuelos. Mm-hmm. The cinnamon cookies you get at Mexican restaurants, but with a little chocolate.
Those are good.
Okay.
It's basically the same shit that's the that like Southern California and like slightly more upscale Mexican restaurants will put on top of Mexican sundaes.
Mm. Oh, I know mm-hmm. what you're talking about. Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. That's a problem.
These are real good.
Don't worry. I will keep you guys mm-hmm. from having to experience mm-hmm. that problem.
Yeah, those are good.
I will take thanks. One or many for the team.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, what's next?
These.
I'm going to carb it up today.
Are.
See Lay's on there.
They're Lay's.
Okay.
They are.
Can I say.
Hot.
They look hot.
Yeah.
There is a W on there.
Mm-hmm.
And when you turned it around and I looked at it, I, in my mind, read Westboro Baptist Lay's. And I was like, that's.
No.
Wow, your brain's a weird place.
It's a weird. It's fucked up here. Let me tell you.
I mean, same.
The guy who runs this office is out of his fucking mind.
How do they smell?
Good.
Spicy?
Not spicy. Really. They're. Ooh.
Yeah.
Spicy.
Oh, there's actually a piece of pepper in here, like a legit.
Oh Jesus!
Oh, nice.
Pepper. I don't know if that's supposed to be in there, but it is, and it's a. The actual flavor is ghost pepper extra chili flavor.
Hell yeah! Oh, let's fucking do this.
Oh boy.
That's from That's a Stefan sketch, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it smells good.
Yeah, they don't smell like...
They don't smell like they're burning my nose.
Yeah.
All right, 3, 2, 1, go.
Okay.
Hell yeah.
Those are good.
Oh, there's the kick.
Yeah.
Oh, there it is.
Oh,
that's good.
Those are really good.
Those are really good.
I like that a lot.
It's that burn stops at the perfect level.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, mine's still going, but it's not unbearable. Like the one chip
I'm gonna
need
a little bit more of that in my life.
What was it? The one chip challenge. That was just hateful. Yeah.
Those are illegal now. Did you know that?
No.
I mean, I can see why, because somebody died, I think.
Yeah, they have been ordered to stop manufacturing those because someone died.
Yeah, I think it was a child.
Yeah.
Died from what?
The,
capsaicin?
Yeah, something like that was just too much. Like, probably an allergic reaction, but I don't know for sure.
I have to wild. Look it up.
They all, but they do a version now that's a sour one, apparently. Mm-hmm. Which, no thank you.
Hmm.
I saw somebody eat the sour one on the TikTok, and it was very funny.
Here's the thing. If you want to try the One Chip Challenge, go to your local store, pick up some Tostinos, the chips.
Tostitos.
Good God.
Totinos are the pizza rolls and pizzas.
Tostitos, or better yet, Juanitas.
Lord's Chips.
The Lord's Chips.
And then hop online to firstsweetfeast.com. Pick up a bottle of The Last Dab.
There you go.
Because that is made with Pepper X, which is the hottest pepper known to man.
Yeah.
Oh, boy. This
and
lingers.
You can just put a little dab on that on a chip.
Mm-hmm.
Pop it down your gullet. And sweat for a couple hours.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That lingers, but I like the flavor. I love it.
Yeah, the flavor is really good.
Really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
Well, all right. Fuck yeah.
Big fan
of our snacks today. Go get them.
Both winners.
Winner. They're wieners.
A majority of the time, I just got them at my local Asian supermarket.
Love it. No,
which one?
Really fucking
good. I can't remember. I want to say either H Mart or Fubon.
All right.
If you're in the Portland area.
Well, all right.
Yeah.
Ooh. Give me them turtles.
Goes.
I do.
First.
Me.
I'll take some of them turtles. I'll pass them to them.
I'm going to take a turtle first.
We got some good snacks today.
We did.
You want to trade?
May make up for some of the future snacks I have.
Oh, God.
Here's the thing. I know what you were just going for. Allow me to bring that to the next level, if I may.
Sure. Thank you.
Yep.
Well done.
That's great. I love it. Yeah, I do go first, by the way. I think I might have said that. I don't remember.
Do it.
And so, hold on. My mouth is spicy.
Woo!
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But also, churro-y. It's a weird combination.
These
but
don't
I'm not
help.
Mad at it. No. I thought they may, but, well, no, a little bit. It's lessening. It's lessening.
I found out from Gordon Ramsay by watching Hot Ones. If you're trying to eat a bunch of spicy food, a spoonful of peanut butter before you go at it.
Oh, before. Mm-hmm. Okay. Kind of coat your...
Yeah.
Coat your throat
and your tummy. You only get a little bit out of it because once you start eating the spicy food, you salivate real bad.
Oh, yeah.
But
that's not going to help anybody.
And then he brought a fire extinguisher full of milk.
That is a delight. That is a delight.
Oh, yeah. There's a bunch of little peppers down in here.
Yeah. I didn't notice that.
Did you want any more of these?
No, I'm good. Thank you. I'm good.
Also, signal me if you want more of these because they're going to be gone very soon.
I am all right. So, in my research over the last month or so, I have come across many great cryptid stories. Obviously, looking directly at our sweet baby beefling from last week. And I almost covered another one this week. Almost. However, I decided that I didn't want to blow my cryptozoological load right away. You're welcome. Because I'm going to need these nerds in the future for when I inevitably need a break from the rough cases. Which will absolutely be returning soon on my end. But not on this day. And not in this Denny's. Mm-mm. For today, I am once again focusing on the ghosts part of our name. And I'm going to tell y'all about the haunting of Heidi Weirich.
All right.
Let's go.
Let's do it.
In 1989, Andrew and Lisa Weirich bought their first home in the small town of Ellerslie, Georgia. At the time, there were roughly 3,000 folks living in Ellerslie, which feels nice and quaint on the surface. But we all know shit's about to get so, so weird. Andy, Lisa, and their 3-year-old daughter Heidi moved into their new house. I believe it had been like a bank foreclosure. Mm-hmm. So it had been abandoned for a while. So they bought it and then they didn't move in right away because they were doing restorations and repairs and things like that.
Yeah.
So, you know, nothing was weird. Then they moved in. Everything seemed okay.
Gonna guess it wasn't.
You're gonna guess correctly.
My mouth is burning.
They moved into the new house. Everything seemed wonderful for a while. Not too terribly long after getting settled, Heidi started telling her parents about the nice old man that would come talk to her in their yard. According to Heidi, Mr. Gordy was his name, and he had, quote, long gray hair, and was usually seen, quote, wearing a suit, tie, and shiny black shoes.
Okay.
In some retellings of the story, it's claimed that Mr. Gordy donned a top hat, but I feel like that was maybe just an unnecessary embellishment that caught on at some point, because I could find no other reports of a top hat. And I'm like, it's already creepy enough, just a random dude showing up in somebody's backyard wearing a suit and tie and shiny shoes, you know, just like a random Tuesday afternoon.
Right.
That's enough to really creep me out. In any event, Heidi would go on to tell her parents that Mr. Gordy would sit with her on the swings, tell her stories, and occasionally hold her hand.
Oh, okay.
After the first mention of Mr. Gordy, Lisa asked Heidi if she'd ever seen him before, to which she responded, quote, no, ma'am, but he promised me he'd come back. He promised to push me on the swing.
Okay. This sounds like how they present the demon in the Exorcist reboot in the show. He's on the porch? Yeah.
Yeah. Also Kane from Poltergeist 2.
Oh, yeah.
So he promised he'd come back, which is sinister when you're a parent of a toddler and you're like, who the fuck is this guy? And rightfully, they were a little bit sketched out by the fact that some strange old man was coming over to their property and chatting up their toddler. But after keeping an especially close eye on Heidi after hearing about Mr. Gordy, they discovered it was something much less sinister. Their almost 4-year-old child simply had an imaginary friend.
Sure.
Lisa would later recall figuring out the almost terrifying relationship, saying, quote, I would see her out in the yard and see her hand raised, holding someone's hand.
Oh, goo.
Many times I would hear her talking, but never heard anybody talk back.
Yeah, that's creepy.
But better than an actual strange man coming into your yard and holding your toddler's hand.
Yes.
So, relief in that instance. But just kidding, because we all know it only gets worse from here. Heidi herself would later say that she never thought Mr. Gordy wasn't a real, living, breathing human person, saying, quote, I saw him up until I was 8 years old, on an everyday basis. We would sit and have conversations, then he would take me by the hand, and we would go swing. The Weyricks noted that Heidi talked about her new friend an awful lot, and as reported in some sources, she'd even offer him food, which he never accepted. Considering the big change in her little world, her parents just chalked up the whole thing to the active imagination of a little girl trying to cope with their recent move.
Sure.
They're like, yeah, okay. Thankful that there wasn't some weird old coot trying to snatch their daughter, the Weyricks dropped their guard a little and accepted that Mr. Gordy would be part of their routine until Heidi got used to the new home. Unfortunately, that was very much not the case. Not terribly long after the appearance of Mr. Gordy, the Weyricks' doorbell rang, and Heidi took it upon herself to answer.
Oh.
Remember, it was still the 80s, and since the 80s need to go to jail, this was an incredibly common thing for kids to do. In fact, I answered the door on my own around the same age, and Heidi is about a year older than I am. Mm-hmm. And boy, oh boy, was my poor mom shocked to find a group of Jehovah's Witnesses in the living room when she got out of the shower.
No!
Whoops! Sorry, Mom. I don't remember what happened next, but I know my mom will tell me, so I can fill y'all in next time. Now, when Heidi answered the door, a man who introduced himself as Khan was standing there. She would later describe him as having, quote, a t-shirt with blood all over it.
Oh, God.
And he had a bandage on his hand with blood on it.
Okay.
No, thank you. She ran to get her mom to help the bloody man on their front step, but by the time Lisa got to the door, he was gone. Naturally freaked out by the whole situation, Lisa said, quote, I brought Heidi in and I locked all the doors and I got the butcher knife out of the drawer and I called my husband to come home. Because keep in mind, this was at the tail end of the Stranger Danger Satanic Panic area in the South. Mm-hmm. So, a little overly cautious. When Andy got home, he and Lisa searched the neighborhood for any signs of the potential kidnapper, but came up with nothing.
Okay.
Seeing as Mr. Gordy and Khan, or Mr. What? Oh, there we go. Mr. Gordy was relatively new in their lives. Lisa was like, I wonder if Mr. Gordy and Khan are the same imaginary friend. The same person. And she said, quote, I thought that Khan and Gordy were the same person, so I thought his name was Khan Gordy. And that's when I started asking everybody, did they or have they ever heard of a name Khan Gordy?
Okay.
She's like, interesting. As it turned out, no one had heard of that particular name, at least not in that specific order. Not terribly long after the Weyricks moved in, they got a new next-door neighbor, Lisa's sister Joyce. So, okay. Lisa's sister moved into the house next door. I want to say maybe a year tops after they first bought the house. So, while visiting with her sister one day, Lisa mentioned Khan Gordy, and the two decided to look into the name and see what they could find. Joyce called her real estate agent to see if she had any information, which, in a roundabout way, she did. She gave her the name of someone. And after checking with the sources provided by her realtor, Joyce had some news for her sister. Khan Gordy was not a person who had lived. However, the house had at one point been owned by a man by the name of James Scarborough Gordy.
Okay.
Joyce managed, she had a copy of the deed to the house, which proved that he had indeed been a very real person who had lived next door to the Weyricks' eventual family home. So, weird. of the revelation that Mr. Gordy had been a real person, Lisa said, quote, "When I saw Mr. Gordy's name on the deed, I was terrified because I knew that the previous owners were there years ago. So I knew that Mr. Gordy had to have been dead."
Oh, yeah.
Yikes. And right, she was. After a bit more digging, the women discovered that James Gordy had passed away in 1974 at the age of 86. In life, he'd been a city commissioner and had owned a real estate company in nearby Columbus for decades. He was also active in the local church, acting as a board member and Sunday school superintendent.
All right.
In their research, they also learned that Joyce's house had another previous owner, Catherine Ledford. After speaking with her, she confirmed that she'd known James Gordy when she was a child, mm-hmm. and that Heidi's description of him, especially the suit, tie, and shiny shoes, had been spot on. Catherine also shared that the man in the bloody shirt sounded an awful lot like her uncle who'd lived in the area and lost a hand in a cotton gin accident when he was a young man.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah. Cotton gin accident. Fuck.
Yeah.
That blows. His name? Lon Batchelor.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Sadly, Lon passed away after a battle with cancer in 1957.
Okay.
Catherine was invited to the Wyricks' house, and when she came over, she brought some old family photos. Unfortunately, she didn't have any of Mr. Gordy, but she did happen to have one of her Uncle Lon mixed in with the rest of the pictures. So Heidi was invited to look through the photos, later saying, quote, "I had never seen any of those people, and when I got to the bottom, there was this little bitty picture. It was Lon Con Batchelor. After watching her small child correctly identify a man that she'd never actually met who'd been dead for over 30 years.
Oof.
Lisa was a little spooked, saying, quote, "When I found out his name really wasn't Con, it was Lon, it scared me to death because I knew Heidi was really seeing something." Mm-hmm. Fucking fair and accurate assessment of the situation there, Lisa. Once she'd learned that baby Heidi's imaginary friends weren't so imaginary after all, Lisa decided to come clean and tell her daughter that Mr. Gordy had died. Mm-hmm. And instead of reacting with sadness or grief, Heidi responded in a way that only children can and requested that they go visit his grave.
Okay.
Mr. Gordy just so happened to be laid to rest at the Park Hill Cemetery in Columbus, Georgia, which is only about a 20-minute drive from Ellerslie. And since it wasn't terribly far away, Lisa agreed. She's like, yeah, sure, why not? On the day of their visit, despite having never been to the cemetery before, Heidi made a beeline straight to Mr. Gordy's final resting place, and I need you all to remember that she was only about 4 years old at the time and still could not really read.
Yeah, no, you can't read at four.
Not really.
It's not she, even really read.
Like, sight words and stuff, apparently, but not great. Not enough to be able to recognize names that she'd never seen written before. Mm-mm. Like, she could probably scrawl her own name in giant backwards letters. Mm-hmm. But that's probably because she had a parent there being like, and then do an age like this. Mm-hmm. But it's not like she's gonna know what that is when she sees it. And she did. And she did. How did she know? My guess is Mr. Gordy was like, hey, girl, I'm over here. I don't know what's happening.
Is that you?
Maybe. I don't know who that is.
Boopy doop. Boopy doop.
Somebody. I have a group text from several numbers I don't recognize, and I don't know who.
Right.
What is happening.
All
right. So, that was fucking weird. To,
yeah.
Like, show up at a cemetery to visit a man that is haunting your house.
Right?
When he lived next door. It's all very strange. Yeah. Over the next 4 years, Mr. Gordy and Con made regular appearances. Mr. Gordy, mostly. Con, I don't think, was as frequent a visitor as Mr. Gordy was. But they showed up in the house, at least to Heidi, pretty regularly.
Uh-huh.
And everyone just kind of accepted that it was going to be a thing and kept going about their lives. I mean, it wasn't...
Sure.
It was a little weird that your daughter is, you know, seeing and talking to ghosts.
And he pushes her on the swing.
But
here for it.
Nothing else worrisome
yeah.
had been going on. Business, just business as usual in a haunted house. That's not to say they were super stoked by the idea.
Fair.
I mean, I'm pretty sure no parent's like, fuck yeah, my kid sees ghosts. One of them was maimed. And that's how he shows up to my toddler. A bloody maimed stump guy.
Yeah, no.
Rad. But no. No. They were like, you know, it could be worse.
It could be. It could and be. It, and for a lot of people, it was.
And it has it, been. It got there. But to try and limit her focus on the spirits, Andy and Lisa decided to get Heidi a dog.
Okay.
From my research, which can get a little fucky for reasons I will explain later, it appears that they had at least two dogs while living in the house or around the time they lived there. The first one was named Wolf, and he was brought home not long after they moved into the home.
Okay.
And the second was a Jack Russell named Clyde, who was purchased after Wolf died. I'm not sure what kind of dog Wolf was, which, as we all know, is a very vital and important piece of information to my brain. Mm-hmm. But I could not find much of anything aside from the fact that he did, in fact, exist.
Oh, with a name like Wolf.
Yeah, I'm feeling like he was pretty big, though, because in a book about the case, his death is explained to have been caused by, quote, dog fight wounds. Oh, and that shit. He died protecting his family.
Oh,
which is sad, and I hate it. Anyway, assuming it was Wolf being referenced in the articles I was reading, he was not a fan of the resident spirits, and would frequently growl, bark, and stare down the seemingly empty hallway or at random corners.
Got it.
Which is never fun.
No.
Some sources claim that Wolf ran away, never to be seen again, but as I just shared, something's fucky, and I don't think that's entirely true.
Okay.
Because again, Wolf died and was expressly mentioned in the book about this case. But I'll get back to that later. So, don't love it.
No.
Just random growling and no, I don't like it. The book would also explain that after a while, the paranormal activity would escalate to the point that both Andy and Lisa started experiencing it. On one dog-related occasion, Lisa was unable to go back to sleep after Heidi had informed her that someone had knocked on their front door twice. It was 3 a.m.
Ew.
Hard pass. She, unlike her husband and daughter, was unable to go back to sleep after this. As she sat in her recliner, she heard Wolf outside, which is where I feel like he spent most of his time from what little info I could find on him. Like, I think he was an outside dog. But he sounded agitated and like he was hiding under the house. The house was just a ranch-style house. So if he were under the front porch, it'd be really easy to hear him from the living room, which I think is where she was sitting at the time. So, you know, she's like, this is not great. He'd been hiding under the house before and, you know, not fun seeing like at one point there was something about how he was hiding under the porch when Mr. Gordy was there. And Heidi was like, why are you hiding under the porch? And then Mr. Gordy showed up and she's like, oh,
that's why.
Yeah. So he starts barking as he's hiding under the house. But before Lisa could do anything about it and, like, try and stop him, she heard a woman telling him, shh, boy, it's okay. I think the fuck not, ma'am.
Oh, boy.
To whomst is it okay? Certainly not me. Certainly not. But, of course, when Lisa went out to check on things, Wolf was alone, and the woman Lisa had heard was nowhere to be found. In addition to that nightmare scenario, Lisa and Andy would both go on to experience things like doors opening and closing on their own, cupboards flying open, random items in the house could be heard moving around with no one else near them. So that's always neat. That's always neat. While Heidi was playing with one of her friends, a very much living child, not a grown dead man, Lisa recalled watching a chair get yanked backwards and topple over as if someone had thrown it. And then, oh boy do I hate it, came the whispers.
Ew.
Lisa claimed to hear voices whispering above her bed and sometimes they called her name.
You're right over there.
My bad.
Yeah.
Back of the chair.
Yeah.
Hit the front of the desk.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all.
But yeah, hearing
no, thank
disembodied
you.
Voices above my bed.
No, thank you.
Saying my name.
Nope.
Again, I think the fuck not.
No, thanks.
The hardest of passes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. In 1993, Lisa learned she was pregnant with another little girl. An exciting time for anyone who wants children. Mm-hmm. Yes and no, in this case. Because up until this point in time, while things had escalated in the home, the paranormal activity was largely manageable. Mm-hmm. I mean, very uncool and scary on occasion, but Heidi never seemed fazed by any of it. Until she started seeing the dark figure.
Oh, no thanks.
Lisa shared that, quote, Heidi had never been scared of anything. She had never been scared of Con. She had never been scared of Mr. Gordy. But when she saw the dark figure in our hallway, she was hysterical. At first, we had talked about moving. But like I told him, I'm assuming her husband, I said, I don't think it would be so good to move. Because wherever we go, she's just got that gift. She's going to see people from the past or people that have been dead. Which is a fair point.
Right?
But still, oh damn. Mm-hmm. Doing what any good Christian family would, Lisa reached out to the local pastor for help, but was unfortunately told that ghosts didn't exist. However, demons did.
Oh no.
Which is neat, and helpful, and neat.
So
thanks. And helpful.
Nope. Just so, the one helpful. Oh, okay.
Ghosts
double
can't
neat.
Exist, but demons can?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. In any event, baby Jordan was born in February of 1994, and instead of being a joyous cause for celebration, shit got worse. This was around the time that all of the poltergeist-like activity had started ramping up, like the cabinets and everything mm-hmm. like that. So when Lisa got pregnant with Jordan was when everything really started to ramp up. And then when the baby was here, worse.
Yeesh.
Because, like I said, that's when all of the activity started picking up. And when the dark figure became a more frequent visitor.
Ew.
Yeah, no thank you. According to Lisa, quote, when the bad spirit started coming into play, it got difficult. She would always describe him as a dark figure, having no features, just like a silhouette. As a parent, you don't know how to deal with it because you don't know how to protect her. If it was someone real, you'd know what to do.
Fair.
Which, again, yeah, fair. Heidi told her parents that there was something bad in the house and that the dark figure, who had decided to lurk in her bedroom as well as the hallway at this point, it would pull her hair and make her room cold.
Rude.
Pass. No, thank you. About 2 weeks after baby Jordan was born, shit got even worse. And how's that now, you may be asking?
Yes.
The new entity decided to get physical with Heidi by scratching the unholy fuck out of her.
Oh, God.
According to Lisa, one morning Heidi, quote, had just deep gashes down her face and it terrified me. I didn't know what it was and I couldn't imagine what could have scratched her that bad.
Yeah.
Andy, meanwhile, just assumed that Heidi had managed to scratch the herself. Shit out of herself in her sleep. Until, that is, 2 nights later, when he woke up in excruciating pain, only to discover that he'd also been scratched to hell, saying, quote, I had 3 claw marks going down my side. The next night I went to sleep and I woke up and I had 3 claw marks down my back. And then it happened again the next night and I woke up and had 3 claw marks down my chest.
Yikes.
So probably not something that you did to yourself in your sleep then?
Yeah.
You didn't think so. After that, the Wyricks decided that it was probably time to bring in some experts to investigate, which means it's time to Dr. William roll that beautiful bean footage, because he is back. If that name sounds familiar, it should, because he was the same expert that investigated the Tatum house that I covered recently. Mm-hmm. Dr. Roll came to check out the Wyricks' home in September of 94. He'd managed to track down a couple of photos of Mr. Gordy. And remember, up until this point, the Wyricks had only heard Heidi's description of him and had no real idea about what he actually looked like. Mm-hmm. They just had a child's description of a ghost that was sort of backed up by a stranger that knew him. So they had no idea. So he was like, I want to bring these pictures to see if Heidi can pick him out without being told who he is.
Right.
Which she did. Mm-hmm. Following their meeting, Dr. Roll said, quote, she came up with physical descriptions and with names that she apparently could not have obtained in any ordinary way. So that immediately made me feel interested in the case. A couple of pictures had been found of Mr. Gordy. The hope was that Heidi would be able to identify Mr. Gordy's picture if they were presented to her with a number of other photographs. Having spoken to Heidi and her parents, I'm even more convinced that we are dealing with genuine parapsychological experiences. Then the question comes up, why are these things happening to this little girl?
Okay.
Why indeed? Well, according to the book, The Veil, Heidi Weirich's story, which just so happens to have been written by her Aunt Joyce, the gift apparently runs in their family. Heidi's grandmother reportedly used to talk about hearing voices and seeing people, but Joyce and Lisa had always assumed that she was just kidding for some reason. Like, maybe trying to scare them, who knows. But they were like, eh, they never really took it seriously. This was further evidenced when Jordan started talking to people who weren't actually there when she was a toddler.
Oh, boy.
One entity in particular was a sad-looking little girl who Heidi would say reminded her of someone on someone from Little House on the Prairie. Mm-hmm. So she just saw this little girl, and that was who baby Jordan was always talking to, just this one little girl.
All right.
I mean, she was the most prevalent of Jordan's sightings. Mm-hmm. I'm sure she also saw Mr. Gordy and Con, but the little girl was like her Mr. Gordy, maybe. Lisa was not a fan of the fact that both of her daughters could see and apparently communicate with spirits. But Heidi assured her that the little girl didn't have any malicious intent. She said she was friendly and her mom didn't need to worry about it. Cool. Which certainly would not stop me from worrying. I'm just going to put that out there. The book also shares that two well-known psychic mediums came to investigate the home. One is unnamed as far as I can find, and the other is potentially Amy Allen.
Oh, okay.
Formerly of The Dead Files. So this is, bless it. So they come to investigate the house. One of them immediately picked up on the spirit of the little girl and Mr. Gordy. She also claimed that there were three quote-unquote dark spirits in the home. Okay. And I think the first psychic that came to check things out was Amy Allen.
Okay.
Not the second one. Because the second one that they called in corroborated the first one's instinct that there were three dark entities in the Weirich house. Only they took it a bit further and claimed that the entities were, you guessed it, demons.
Oh.
Exactly.
Oh, do we got them?
According to these people, yeah.
Okay.
One of them was trying to attach itself to Heidi, while another one was attempting to take up residence in Jordan's room, presumably for the same reason. And the third demon liked to pass through the living room wall and into Lisa and Andy's bedroom, where it liked to chill over their bed. And I'm assuming this would be the same entity that liked to whisper Lisa's name while she tried to sleep.
Yeah.
However, she noted that there was a spirit in the home that actively tried protecting the family, especially Heidi and Jordan, that the family ultimately believed was Mr. Gordy. Mm-hmm. She then told the Weirichs that there was a portal in the living room fireplace and that the demons that had found their way through it had no plans on leaving the house anytime soon. After these meetings, the family called on their pastor to come cleanse the house, which he did. But just like several of the haunting stories we've told over the years, it did not help at all. Right? Crazy how that works out. In fact, at some point during all of this, shit got even worse. One evening, Heidi woke up with an overwhelming sense of dread, which, been there, hate that. She knew something bad was about to go down, which may have had something to do with the dark figure creeping at the end of her bed.
Okay, yeah, that'll do it.
Yeah, no. She screamed for her parents, who promptly ran into her room, only to find their daughter hanging upside down next to her bed, as if someone had snatched her up and was dangling her by her leg.
Holy shit!
Hardest of passes!
Oh, shit.
No thanks. No thanks.
Damn. All right.
Some sources claim that the Weyricks moved out of the house shortly after the incident, which...
Yeah, bye.
But according to the book, the family lived in the house for a total of about 15 years. During which, each member of the family would experience various physical ailments, tragedies, and hardships that the entire family would later privately attribute to whatever dark entities had caused the activity in the home.
Okay.
Now, could that final incident have taken place when Heidi was almost an adult? Sure. But I don't think so. And I'll get to that previously mentioned fuckiness in just a second. And it's also worth noting that the activity did not stop when they moved. So it's not like it would have mattered.
Right.
If they had moved right away or lived there for the rest of their days. As it always does, local media got wind of the Weyricks haunted house, which ended up bringing a ton of attention to the family, and not necessarily the good kind. Mm. Lots of skeptics and detractors spewing accusations and unnecessary meanness, you know, the usual. Their case would go on to be featured in a 1994 episode of Unsolved Mysteries and was the subject of a 2002 documentary on the Discovery Channel called A Haunting in Georgia. Heidi and her family made several appearances at paranormal conventions over the years, and in 2013, a movie based off of the book about Heidi's life and gifts was turned into The Haunting in Connecticut 2, Ghosts of Georgia. Yes, exactly. This is why I said
something. I didn't even know that there was a 2.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Okay. But this is why I said some things in the sources were a little fucky, because I think some folks may have inadvertently taken things from the movie and reported them as if they were fact.
Got it.
But on the other hand, as far as I can tell, the movie follows the book pretty closely, so what the fuck do I know? I have seen the movie in the past and had no idea it was based on this case until I started researching it.
Mm-hmm.
The movie was fine.
Sure.
It's only related to the original Haunting in Connecticut movie because of the name and they had the same production company. The sequel has a slightly higher tomato meter score on Rotten Tomatoes, at 19% versus 17% to the original.
I don't know what that means.
You don't need to. It's not for you. it's not for you. Okay. But the audience score for the original is slightly better than that of its counterpart.
Rotten Tomatoes.
I know what it is.
Oh.
I just don't know what's good or bad.
Certified Fresh, I believe, is anything 60 or over.
Yeah.
So
the tomato meter score is like
critics, and then the audience score is the audience.
Yeah.
Most of the time, the audience score is more reliable.
Yeah.
The critic score oftentimes is trash.
Yeah, because both movies have an audience rating that's under 50%. So. Yeah.
Most of the time, the audience is right, and the critics are wrong.
Yeah.
Okay.
But when they're both matched, you know it's accurate.
Yeah. I would definitely not say that the sequel is, it's not even technically a sequel. They just have the same title.
Connecticut and Georgia are two different states.
Well, yeah, and it's two completely different families. It has nothing to do. They're not related in any way, shape, or form. They were just like, hey, people liked this movie, so let's just slap that title on it and get people to, and it did not really work. It's fine. But the first one is more enjoyable.
Got it.
At least to me. As for the Weyricks, where are they now?
I don't know.
Sadly, Andy Weyrick passed away in 2012 at the age of 45.
Oh, bummer.
Don't ask me why, because I could not find the cause of his very sudden and untimely passing anywhere. Bummer. There was a very insane person in the comments on the Unsolved Mysteries website saying that it was because he had been in a psychiatric hospital and someone passed out cigarettes laced with meth.
Oh.
And that's how he died?
Meth cigarette?
Uh-huh. I was like, who? But that same commenter made another comment further down the thread where they said that he was actually, Andy Weyrick was actually alive and living by a different name, I think, in South America. And I'm like, oh, well, Someone may have had a meth cigarette, but I do not think it was Andy Weirich. And I think you need to leave your internet, please. Because what you're saying is very weird.
Leave your internet now.
Yes. Lisa remarried at some point and is still in Georgia. Heidi got married and had kids of her own. As for whether or not she still sees spirits, it looks like she does, though not as frequently as when she was younger.
All right.
She stopped seeing Con and Mr. Gordy when she was around 8, but has previously said that she continued to see the dark entity from the Ellerslie house for years, adding that none of the sightings really fazed her much anymore.
That's good.
She also shared, quote, "I can sense when it's an evil presence or if it's a good presence. If I can sense evil, you wouldn't believe the feelings you can get. I've been literally sick to my stomach."
Oof, fair.
Yeah. When asked about her childhood and her gift, she said, quote, "It means so much to me to help people out there who are going through the same thing as me. You'll have people believe you 100%, and then some people think you're crazy. There's no in-between. Most of the time, I've learned to keep a lot of it to myself, and I really don't even notice it. You get used to seeing things after a while. Every day, I wish these things wouldn't have happened because my life would be so much different. I wouldn't be known for something like this." End quote.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the story of Heidi Weirich and the Weirich family haunting.
Yeah, we recorded that whole thing.
I love that.
Thank God. Thank
I love that for everybody.
God. Hooray.
Yeah, I love that the for everyone.
The end.
All right. Nice. Yeah, well,
Second, no thanks. And there was some other stuff mentioned in the book about weird, creepy things that happened. And I was just like, oh, I don't like any of it. Mm-mm. No thanks.
No, hauntings aren't great.
Not that
generally,
one.
Generally. I mean, they're not.
Not that you one. You know,
generally not fun.
No. So. No. Unless you've got haunted bunk beds.
Unless you have haunted bunk
and then
beds.
That, even then, that's only fun for me. sources, IMDb, WTVM.com, Ranker, Jacob Shelton, Listverse.com, a user just named Estelle.
All right.
Angelfire.com.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious that it still exists, but it was an archived site called Gone and Almost Forgotten in Georgia by, I believe, someone named Jan Doolittle Page.
I don't even know what Angel Fire is. I just thought that was a cool website.
It's an ancient website source from the very early to mid-90s.
Got it.
Like GeoCities. Just the one. One of the funny things I always say when I'm making up websites, Angel Fire is one of them.
Got it.
Yeah.
And I don't know what GeoCities is either.
So. It's also one of those websites that is just nobody not uses for me. Anymore. Nope. That not is also not for you.
Not for me.
Nope. Unsolved.com, findagrave.com, chatvoice.com, a staff article, sitcoms online, rottentomatoes.com, horrorhomeroom.com, Steve A. Wiggins, ahaunting.fandom.com, dannyhendrix.medium.com, Danny Hendrix. Unsolvedmysteries.fandom.com. The Deadly Discourse Podcast, Episode 3, The Weirich House, as told by Reese and Holly. And The Veil, Heidi Weirich's Story by Joyce Cathy and Rebecca S. Harrington.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Hauntings, never fun.
Shit on a shingle. Beds, let's do this. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'm gonna put on my eye barts.
Okay.
I don't know what just happened. I think my brain shorted out.
That reminds me. Wow. Z will get this, but.
I think my brain just shorted
out. I'm just a Jesus loving ex Marine.
Barts.
My brain immediately went to the golden child.
Barts. Put on your eye barts. Huh?
They're on.
Yeah, that one.
You got it.
Yeah. Mine just went to, I want the knife. Please, from the Golden Child, because it's hilarious and the 80s.
I found out something dangerous.
Oh, God.
The Criterion subreddit has a thread of people trying to sell their movies.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Do you guys know what Criterion is?
Yeah.
No.
You do. Yeah, I figured you would.
Come on now.
It's not. That's also not for you. Yeah, nothing so. On this day is for you.
No. Get out.
Nothing on this day that is technology related.
Criterion is a cinephile organization that gets permission from filmmakers and studios and whatnot to remaster and redo their movies.
Okay.
and they assign like an individual producer to each one that sources a bunch of extra content. And then they make like box sets and updated copies and versions of them to sell for a little bit more. But the subreddit has a list of people who are trying to sell them for way cheap.
Okay.
So if I go into a crazy amount of financial debt.
We now know why.
We now know why. But I'm almost out of room in my credit cards. So, you know, I'm going to stop pretty soon.
Heard and word.
Anyway, go ahead.
So, buckle up.
Don't tell me what to do.
Put on our thinking hats. It just, lots of red strings today.
Oh, one of those.
Lots of red strings. The story is soups, banoons, to say the very fucking least. It is very much unsolved-ish. Ish. And has a whole lot of theories, but you'll see. Okay. So, picture it.
On it.
Vatican City.
Don't tell me what to do.
Okay.
2018.
Oh, boy.
Oh, recently.
Four men were renovating a basement floor near the Vatican's Apostolic Nunciature. That's a hard word.
Yeah.
Nunciature. When they uncovered an entire skeleton, as well as some other bones scattered around, they immediately reported what they just found to the Vatican gendarmes. It's not the Swiss guys. It's their own police. And they passed the information to the Holy See, who told the Rome authorities. Now, I'm going to translate all of that to you.
Okay.
Vatican City is basically...
It's own thing.
It's its own little country state within a country state. And they have their own police. The Holy See is the government that operates within the Vatican. And the Pope is basically the king slash president. So the Italian authorities launched an inquiry to find out if the remains belonged to two missing girls that had disappeared from Rome in 1983. That would be Emanuela Orlandi and Mirella Gregori. And to this day, the families do believe that their disappearances are connected. Now, human remains have been found before below the floors of several Vatican buildings, and Vatican sources suggest that it's because there once had been a cemetery there on the grounds. However, Italian media reported that the floor in question was last renovated in the 1980s, and that the manner of burial suggested that the remains found, well, those bodies had not died of natural causes.
Uh-oh.
So after the announcement, Emanuela Orlandi's brother Pietro made a statement to the media saying, "I was amazed the Vatican police immediately came up with the idea that it could be the remains of Emanuela and Mirella Gregori. How did they make that connection?" Hmm. Antoinetta Gregory told Italian media that she hoped that the remains were her sister's, saying, "I don't want to fool myself. I want to keep my feet on the ground, but in my heart, I hope the bones are Mirella's so we can bring this story to an end and I will have somewhere to cry and lay a flower to my sister."
Hmm.
So now let's back it up.
Yes.
So 15-year-old Mirella disappeared on May 7th, 1983. She left her house around 3:30 p.m. after receiving a phone call telling her mother that it had been a former classmate of hers from middle school named Alessandro, and that she was going to go meet him and would be back in 10 minutes. So Mirella then went downstairs and into the bar just under her home to meet with the owner's daughter and her best friend, Sonia DeVito. The two girls talked privately, locked in the bathroom for around 10 minutes. Then Mirella left the bar and went outside. And that was the last time she had ever been seen. After she was reported missing, Alessandro was located and questioned, but he had a rock-solid alibi and said that he hadn't spoken to Mirella in months. 3 months later, Emanuela Orlandi would go missing. And here's where the weirdness starts. Not that this wasn't weird.
Yeah.
But this is red strings, thumbtacks, get them out.
Yes, I know this case.
Oh, boy, yes. So 15-year-old Emanuela disappeared June 22, 1983. She lived with her family in Vatican City. Her father, Ercole, was an employee of the papal household, and she and her four siblings had free reign of the Vatican Gardens. On the day she went missing, she left home around 4 p.m. to go to her music lesson. She was running late and asked her older brother, Pietro, to drive her, but he didn't. He really didn't have much else going on. He just kind of was like, oh, no, I've got other shit to do. But he really didn't. They kind of argued about it. Mm-hmm. And that was something he's regretted for decades, saying, I've gone over it so many times, telling myself if only I had accompanied her, maybe it wouldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. So Emanuela played the flute. She was in the choir. She had a big concert coming up. So after class, however, Emanuela called home and told her sister Frederica that before her lesson, she'd been approached by a man who had given her a job offer to sell an Avon. He was an Avon rep.
Oh, okay.
And he had given her a job offer to hand out flyers at a fashion show for a couple hours. And she told her sister that she would meet him at the end of her lesson to give the answer. So Frederica was like, sketch, super sketch.
Don't do it.
Don't accept. No. That's sus. Apparently the amount of money that was offered was kind of astronomical.
For what the job was, especially.
Right. So she's like, it's probably a scam. How about you talk with our parents about this first?
Yeah.
So she hangs up the phone, and while leaving school, Emanuela spoke about the job with two of her female classmates who left her at the bus stop. And the bus stop in, so many Italian words, basically in Corso Rinascimento in front of the Palazzo Madama. Okay.
Okay.
Anyway, so she was supposed to be heading to meet her sister Maria Cristina and some friends, but she never showed. So the friends, she's talking about this Avon job. They do their thing. Mm-hmm. She's still at the bus stop going to meet her sister, and that was that. So she never showed to meet her sister. She was supposed to meet around 7, but she was last seen around 7:30 still at the bus stop in the company of another girl who was never identified and probably was not even connected.
Yeah.
But when her sister didn't show up where they were supposed to meet, Maria Cristina went home and asked if Emanuela was there, but she wasn't. So after a couple hours of waiting for her to come home, her family began to worry, and they started looking for her around 9:30 p.m. in the area between the Vatican and the music school. They called the director of the school to ask if any of Emanuela's classmates had any information. Then Ercole went to the police to report her missing, but they told him it was too soon to do a report. She's probably just out with some friends. Come back tomorrow if she doesn't come home.
That old chestnut.
Yeah, well, she didn't, and Emanuela was officially declared missing the next day. In the first days after the disappearance, Giulio Gangi, a friend of the Orlandi family and an agent of SISD, it's Italy's CIA. Because a lot of these articles were in Italian,
mm-hmm.
and so it's kind of hard to, and then I'm like looking up SISDE, and it's all Italian words, and it doesn't,
right, you're like, wait.
Do you speak Italian? Then you'd know, but if you don't, it's like the CIA. Yeah. Anyway, so he helped them in the initial investigations. Two witnesses had been found through him, a traffic officer and a retired police officer. And both men had seen a girl that fit Emanuela's description talking to a man holding an Avon bag. One of them saw them talking before her music lesson, and the other was around 7 p.m., which would have been after class. And they both said that the man was driving a dark green BMW, and it was described as being between 35 and 40 years old.
Oh.
So Ganji managed to track down the car, which was in a repair shop, because one of its windows had been broken from the inside.
I really hate that.
He also found that the car belonged to a woman, But before he could dig any deeper, he was removed from the investigation by his superiors.
Hmm.
Suspect. Highly fucking questionable. So, Emanuela's uncle called one of the papers, Il Tempo, and told them about his niece's disappearance and asked if they would just do a short piece with a photo, which they did. And on the 24th of June, it ran. The family had their phone number put into the article.
Oh, no.
Hoping that someone would come forth with some information, which I get, but maybe not the best of ideas. So there were lots of calls. Mostly crazies.
Yeah.
But then, at around 6 p.m. on Saturday, June 25th, a phone call came in from a young man who claimed to be a 16-year-old named Pierluigi.
Okay.
He said that he and his fiance, yes, fiance, had met a girl that fit Manuela's description in Campo di Fiore. He said that she had a flute case, she had long dark hair and a pair of glasses, which she did have, but she really didn't like wearing, along with other details that fit the description of her. Except according to Pierluigi, the girl introduced herself as Barbara and that she had run away from home and was selling Avon. So then, until that point, everything was making some sense. The description fit, the fact that Avon was mentioned.
Her flute.
Right, which was not yet public knowledge. I mean, there really was no big public knowledge to be had.
That was going to be my next question, because
they didn't put it in the paper.
I had forgotten if that was a detail that they'd released yet.
No, they did not. So it led the family to think that could have been her.
Yeah.
Pierluigi called two more times the same day, and then again on the 26th, giving some other information, some about himself and more details about the girl that he and his fiance had met. So the family was like, well, what the fuck? This all fits, except Emanuela wouldn't be running away from home.
Yeah, and why is she telling you her name is Barbara?
Yeah, right?
Unless he was giving off a real creepy vibe, and she just lied.
That too. Then later that same day, two men showed up at the Orlandi's home saying that they were from SISDE and that they were there to set up a recording device on the family phone and that all incoming calls were to be recorded from that point on, which was weird because no one had told them anything about any fucking phone calls. Their only connection to the SISDE was their homie.
Friend.
Right.
Yeah.
Who had been pulled off the case.
Yeah. Yeah, and if he's pulled off the case.
Now, he could have mentioned it to someone, but all of a sudden they're like, at your door saying, hey,
we're gonna record all your phone calls.
So they set up a recording device and basically said, if anything fishy comes in, you press record.
Yeah.
So on June 28th, the week after Emanuela had disappeared, the Orlandis got a call that they did record from a man calling himself Mario. Mario claimed to own a bar near Ponte Vittorio, which was between the Vatican and the music school. He said that he knew a guy that was living with his girlfriend and that they had two girls staying with them who sold Avon.
Okay.
One of them was a young girl from Venice named Barbara, who had confided to him about being a runaway and that she was upset that she was missing a music concert at school. Another detail that was not released to the public. But again, the only real public release was the family's article at this point. Nothing. There was no media coverage. There was
nothing.
No.
In the papers be like, hey, this girl's missing. Keep an eye out.
Right.
Just the thing her family was like, hey, our daughter is missing. Here's our phone number.
And it wasn't until the 29th. That the family started putting up missing posters all over Rome. And I mean all over. So no one could ignore them at this point. Not even the Vatican.
Yeah.
So every Sunday, the Pope, John Paul II at the time, would speak to the crowds from a balcony in St. Peter's Square. That was just a normal thing he did every Sunday. Just a little Hi, I'm holy. Have a great whatever. You
it's
know,
a just me, the Pope.
Pope, that exactly.
Howdy, still the Pope.
Yep.
Is it Pope John Paul II the one that Sinead O'Connor ripped up the picture of on SNL?
I think so.
I think.
Sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, Sunday, July 3rd, he was doing his Sunday, hey, I'm in the Pope.
Mm-hmm.
Except he started talking about Emanuela Orlandi. So he told the crowd about the missing girl, and he issued an appeal to those responsible for her disappearance, which was the first time that the hypothesis of kidnapping had ever been made.
Mm.
Now, many people thought this was odd, especially the media. Why would the Pope mention a missing girl, considering there were many throughout all of Italy?
Yeah. Why this one specifically?
It could have been that she was a Vatican citizen. Only around 100 people lived in Vatican City. And the Orlandi family itself had served 7 popes.
Oh, so they've been there.
The Orlandis had been in Vatican City for a long ass time.
Yeah.
But what was considered odd was that the Pope was very clearly spoke of Emanuela as being taken and urged those responsible to release her. But the authorities were all along the Avon lead. The runaway Barbara and the Avon and the Avon guys.
Yeah. Hey, so, Papa, what secrets you know? I mean, several, right. Many, but specifically relating to this. And yes, I looked it up. That was the Pope that she ripped the picture of.
So was John Paul speculating? Or did he know something that no one else did? So 2 days later, after the Pope's speech on July 5th, the Orlandis got a phone call, which, again, was recorded, and was the first of a number of calls from a man speaking Italian with a very, very American accent.
Ooh.
Almost.
Gorlami.
Exactly. Almost too American, in my opinion.
Where it's like, that would take a very special kind of skill to...
Parmigiano Reggiano.
Well, to speak...
But that's how bad it is.
There's like 3 minutes straight of Inglourious Basterds to quote, and you choose Parmigiano Oregano.
I've actually never seen Inglourious Basterds.
I am sent... Do you have a Blu-ray player?
No, maybe. No.
You can find it on streaming, I can find,
yeah.
But also, it's like... My brain is imagining someone fluent in Italian, speaking Italian.
It very fluent.
But putting on an American affect.
Yeah.
With the, and which is just difficult to overdo unless you're a very good actor.
So it's.
If any of that made sense.
Yes. And you could tell from.
It's like when people, when you hear like the 911 calls or calls between kidnappers and whoever they're trying to get a ransom from when they're trying to disguise their voice, which is a word I could not remember a second ago, disguising it. But that's going like extra.
Right. So.
Steps.
I've heard it. And like I said, it's almost like it's an overly forced American accent.
Mm-hmm. Where it's like, I'm trying but to they're throw you
speaking
off.
Speaking Italian fluently.
Yeah.
So I don't think it was an American. I think.
No, that's what I'm saying. Like, go and disguise your voice with that extra step is impressively sinister.
Yeah. Oh, it gets worse.
I know.
No, it gets worse.
I know.
So very, very, very forced American sounding accent. And the first thing that he said was, Mr. Orlandi, I spoke with your daughter tonight. And then if it couldn't get any creepier, the man who would only call himself the American played a recording of a girl's voice repeating certain phrases several times.
I don't like it.
First, she said, National School Vittorio Emanuele II. That was her school. Over and over and over.
Yep.
The recording. And then, I should be in the third year of high school next year.
Oh, hate that.
Over and over and over. And according to the Orlandis, there was no doubt that it was Emanuela's voice.
I hate it.
Stick a pin in that.
I don't want
the Orlandis doubts.
Can we skip that?
Must we?
So, stick a pin in it.
I don't want
to. So, the American also said that the family had already been contacted by two members of his organization. Pierre Luigi and Mario. And that they were all part of a terrorist organization that was holding Emanuela Orlandi prisoner and demanding the release of Mehmet Ali Acha, who was the Turkish man who had shot Pope John Paul in May of 1981. So the family asked what they needed to do. And they were told by the American not to worry. Someone would be in touch with instructions very soon. But the deadline for the Italian officials to release Ali Acha would be July 20th, or they would kill Emanuela. So, the next day, July 6th, the American called the newsroom of the Agenzia Nazionale Stampa Associata.
You did it.
Thank you. Good job. Sounded really good, didn't it?
It did.
Sounded great. Anyway.
Probably sounded exactly like that guy that was making the phone calls with the fake American accent.
Yep. So, called them and said, "We have had contact with the Vatican secretary, a message that the Vatican is hiding. In the Parliament Square, in a rubbish bin, you will find the proof that the girl is in our hands." So, basically, he's saying, "Hey, we told the Vatican, they're not telling you.
Yeah.
But we've got her, and here's the proof." So, the editor went and looked into the garbage can and found a photocopy of Emanuela's school ID, a receipt for an exam fee that she had, the phone number of the Orlandi household, and a handwritten note that said, "With great affection, your Emanuela." So the Orlandi family believed 100% the handwriting was hers, hands down.
Mm-hmm.
The authorities, however, didn't necessarily disagree, but they felt that because everything was a photocopy, that maybe the kidnappers don't actually, or whoever these people are, don't actually have her, but they have access to her personal effects. And and they suggested that if the American call again to ask for proof that Emanuela was alive. So, the American was now calling the Vatican's then Secretary of State, Agnostino Casaroli, a Catholic priest and diplomat for the Holy See. A total of 16 calls were made by the American from different public telephones, and Emanuela's disappearance was now becoming global news. You know, the Pope had talked about it. It's getting to the United States because United States reporters were like, "Why is the Pope talking about this girl?"
Yeah.
What's going on?
What's happening here?
Well, and now that the whole Mehmet Ali Acha terrorist thing, like, this is becoming a global...
Yeah, like, oh, this is a much bigger deal.
Much bigger deal. Much, much, much bigger deal.
Than previously believed.
So, on July 8th, which is 12 days to the Americans' deadline, Mehmet Ali Acha was brought into Rome's police headquarters for questioning, and as he was walking in, made a very public statement to the cameras, saying, "I am against this criminal action. I am with the innocent girl and her ailing family. I am with Italy. I am with the Vatican."
Okay.
He also dropped a bombshell, saying in Italian that he was sorry for all the trouble and that he, in fact, did not try to kill the Pope because of the Grey Wolves. The Grey Wolves is the reason, supposedly, that he shot the Pope, which is a Turkish militant group, but that's a whole other issue. Look it up if you want.
Not on this day.
Not on this day. Not at this fucking Vatican Denny's.
Exactly.
But...
God, could you imagine if there was a Denny's in the Vatican?
There's not.
I wish.
I've been there.
There's not.
In my heart.
But...
Yes.
The reason that he tried to assassinate the Pope was because of the Bulgarians... and the KGB.
Okay.
So now this is all becoming a clusterfuck of epic proportions, and the Orlandi family found themselves in the middle of an international fucking conspiracy.
Wow,
let's try that again.
Conspiracy.
I love how Italian came out of your face totally fine at one point. The conspiracy is the one that got you today.
Yeah, on this day.
On this day.
In this Denny's. Yeah.
In this Denny's.
Yes, this Vatican Denny's. But so they were afraid that Emanuela had become a pawn in some great fucking plan or scheme.
Yeah, which...
But whose?
Yeah.
On July 17th, the American called ANSA again, which is the Agencia Nacional Estampa Asociata.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And said that an audio cassette could be found in the rubbish bin near their office. They were given a very specific location, and one of the journalists hauled ass out to get it. There was a package in the garbage can, and in it was a cassette. On one side was a recording of the usual demands for the release of Aliacha, but on the other side, what was reported was the sounds of a girl being tortured.
Really?
Saying, "Why? Oh God, it hurts. Oh my God, yes." Right. Now, to me, it sounded very, very, very much like porn.
I was like, that doesn't sound like torturing
someone. It was the, oh my God, yes. And it sounds like porn.
Yeah.
Very, very much like porn. So, the police told the family that they did not believe that to be Emanuela, but her brother expressed doubts, which, stick a pin in that. Where was I? There I am. So, however, former Digos agent, Digos is Italy's anti-terrorist division.
Gotcha.
Antonio Asciore, who first found and listened to the cassette, claimed that the recording that was given to the family and later published was not the original that was found. So he claimed that the original recording was longer than the published recording and that a male voice could be heard in its background. The presence of male voices was also reported in the original transcription of the recording made by the police, which supports his claims that the published recording had been manipulated or faked.
Okay.
So who knows? On July 20th, which was the deadline for Aliacha's release, the American made a final call around 10:30 a.m. This time, randomly to just a random church in Rome.
Sure.
Where he spoke with the priest there, a Father Ambrogio, telling him, "This is the last statement for Orlandi." Father Ambrogio was like, "I have no fucking idea what you're talking about."
I'm sorry, what?
And then he realized the last name. This guy's talking about the missing girl that he had seen in the news. And the man then told him that there were just a few hours left to release Mamet Aliacha before they were going to kill Emanuela. So this poor priest, like, he's like, okay.
Help.
Right? So he, of course, alerted the authorities and the Orlando family. And at that point, all of Rome waited. Italian journalist Andrea Purgatori, who had been following the case very closely.
That's a pretty fucking cool name.
It's a great name. He knew from his experience in covering terrorism that in a kidnapping, there's always more than one deadline.
Touché.
So,
heads up, we're recording.
Great. So the Orlandis and Rome, everyone's waiting. Well, nothing happened.
Shocking.
Then, on August 4th, 1983, ANSA received a written statement from an organization calling itself the Turkish Anti-Christian Turkish Liberation Front.
That's too many things.
Yep. Well, it's Turkish and then Turkish. Later simply just referred to as Turkish.
Okay, that's... So.
Now...
Keep it brief.
Simple. Yeah. So, they claimed that they were holding Emanuela Orlandi in exchange for Aliacha's release. So we went from July 20th, where everybody's waiting, to August 4th. So Turkesh sent 7 letters in total between August 83 and November 1985.
Okay.
Although they showed no evidence of Emanuela's captivity, Turkesh was able to provide many precise details about her private life, including the number of moles on her back.
Oh, that's weird.
It's creepy. In the first Turkesh statement, there was an ambiguous reference to Mirella Grigori.
Okay.
And in the following days, both Turkesh and the American, he's back, confirmed that both Orlandi and Grigori were their captives. And on October, somehow I managed to leave off the number. At the request of the Orlandi and Grigori families, Italian... Oh, it's October 10th. Right? Sure. Love yeah. that for me.
It's in front of you.
Well, it's not because I didn't. Anyway. I'm making up numbers now, but I'll back home myself. It's fine.
Okay. At the request I keep of telling the, you. Something due on your own time.
Of the Orlandi and Grigori families, Italian President Sandro Pertini made a public appeal for the girls' release on October 20th. 1983, linking the two cases for the first time publicly.
Interesting.
So from this moment on, the Italian Secret Service appointed both the Orlandis and the Grigoris the legal aid of a lawyer, Gennaro Idigio, whom they were told had a very long career in international affairs, terrorism, and international crimes, and that all calls from the alleged kidnappers would be redirected to his office. So the families made public statements to support all of that and told the kidnappers to give their lawyer proof of life.
Yeah.
Well, y'all, according to Andrea Purgatori, Gennaro Idigio was a bankruptcy lawyer.
Oh, well, that's not very helpful here.
With zero experience in terrorism, hostage negotiations, or any type of fucking crime. And that's when Purgatori started to dig. He knows that the normal practice in a kidnapping for ransom is that the kidnapper very quickly calls with their demands. Yeah. Right? Mirella Grigori disappeared on May 7th.
And it's now October?
Uh-huh. Yeah. And Emanuela Orlandi on June 22nd. However, there was no phone call with any sort of demand or reference of a kidnapping until July 5th.
Okay.
2 days after the Pope's speech about Emanuela. Before that, all the calls that came into the Orlandi family were about her being a runaway and selling fucking Avon.
Yeah, and someone named Barbara, apparently.
Right, and there was zero mention of Mirella at all until that August 4th. So what the fucking fuck was going on? And who was really behind all of this? So the Grey Wolves were originally thought to be who Mehmet Aliacha attempted to assassinate the Pope for. Yet the American never mentions them. Only the other members of his group, Pierluigi and Mario. That's the only thing he ever mentioned in the beginning, which are very Italian names. They spoke Italian just fine. And at the time, Italian intelligence knew of no connection between the Grey Wolves and anyone in Italy other than Mehmet himself.
Okay.
So now all of a sudden, so the American is supposedly with Turkesh.
Yeah.
Except he never mentioned that, just his terrorist group that and he was a part of with and his two other members, Pierluigi and Mario.
Yeah. And now all of a sudden it's this giant
fucking thing.
Organization.
Yes.
Which.
Right.
The you sure about that?
Right? The final phone call from the American to the family's lawyer was on December 14th, 1983. And then, silence. Which Pietro Orlandi says is the most distressing thing a family can experience because that silence can mean anything.
Yeah.
And then on December 24th, Eric Cole got a phone call saying that the Pope would be at their home shortly.
Oh, Christ.
The fucking Pope.
I mean, almost literally.
The fucking Pope.
If you're into that kind of thing.
The fucking Pope.
The fucking Pope? The fucking, or the Pope. Fucking Pope.
The fucking Pope.
The fucking. Very important distinction. Is this Pope the fucking Pope, or is he the fucking Pope?
Well, he's not the fucking Pope. Because
he's not the fucking Pope.
The Pope is a virgin who can't drive.
I mean, not with that attitude.
It's not my attitude. That's just Pope business. It's papal, right? papal business.
It's Pope business. It's none of mine.
So
exactly,
the fucking Pope, John Paul II,
JP2,
shows up at the Orlandi's front door on Christmas fucking Eve to do Pope shit. Right? He hugged the Orlandi's, did Christmas Pope shit. Which they all knew was because of Emanuela and mm-hmm. being a citizen of the Vatican. It was all very special until he said with downturned eyes, "We are doing everything humanly possible. Unfortunately, Emanuela is a case of international terrorism."
Yeah.
Meanwhile, none of what had gone down was sitting well with Andreas Purgatori. Sorry, I just mic'd my mic.
Can you?
Nope, I sure can't. So, the whole international kidnapping terrorism wasn't making any fucking sense. This was like his wheelhouse. This is what he writes about. He's like, no. So, he reached out to one of his sources, a very high-ranking official of the Italian Secret Service. So, he and his source meet up, and this is what source said, "Andreas, listen. They had no strategy. Can you imagine the KGB handling a kidnapping with no strategy?"
Touche.
The source also told him that they had analyzed the torture recording and it had 100% come from a porn.
That sounds right.
He then said, "This is not a terrorist plot. Nothing to do with Mehmet Aliacha. Nothing to do with the Bulgarians or the KGB. Terrorism is just a decoy to divert attention from some secret which took place inside the Vatican. Exactly what kind of information the Pope received about Emanuela and who was really behind this case, we don't know."
Oof.
So, Andreas wrote an article about the case and implied that Emanuela's disappearance had everything to do with the Vatican. Some sort of crime, maybe some money.
Mm-hmm.
Who knows? But within a day of that article coming out, his editor came to him and told him to back the fuck off.
Well, that's not sinister.
Take a step back from this case now.
Mm.
And that's when Andreas knew.
He was onto something.
That he was onto something. And this case is about to get even fucking weirder.
Yeah, which seems impossible.
But it's not.
It tis nay.
And except that is for next week.
Nice.
And I hate to do a two-parter, but I've also got a Patreon to do and two markets in the next 2 weeks. And I'm going to pull it all out of my ass somehow. But yeah, no, this case gets weirder.
It is a really fucking weird case.
It's already soup spinoons.
Yeah, it's just when you think it couldn't get more crazy, it does.
Yeah. Like, in 2018, they're like, "Oh, we know who that is." Oh, why? Why would you know?
Oh, okay.
All kinds of bodies have been found under buildings here. Why are we automatically saying, "Oh, that's who this is"?
It's exactly. We know.
We know. That's who this is.
Hey,
oh,
girl.
Oh, is it? Because y'all couldn't seem to find either one of these girls in the 80s, but now all of a sudden you're totally sure that's who it is?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we will have to get there next week.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
It's a real fucking...
And the reason I kept saying, the family's like, "Nope, they're sure it's her handwriting. Oh, yep, nope, they're sure that's her voice. That's porn. I know you want it to be Emanuela so badly."
Yeah.
And it's always her brother, because he's the one that, you know, he feels that if he had just driven her that day, then none of this would have happened. But, and who's the fucking Avon guy?
Also a real fucking good question.
And so why would Turkesh, if Turkesh is behind this, and really it's because they want Ali Acha released.
Sure.
Ali Acha free.
Yes, exactly that. They want Ali Acha free. Why bother having Pierluigi and Mario and then all of a sudden the American?
Yeah. Like, what is...
Speaking fluent fucking Italian with a very, very obviously forced American accent.
Yeah.
Why?
Like, what is... What
just
is...
to come out and be like, we are Turkish nationals and we want... We're a Turkish terrorist organization. Like, what the fuck? Right? And so the American is part of Turkish? Yet all y'all are speaking Italian. Now, I get it. You're speaking to Italians, but like I said, like Pierluigi and Mario.
Yeah.
Italian, the Italy CIA, they're like, no. We have absolutely the only tie in Italy to them would be Mehmet.
Yeah. And it's just like,
and
the fuck
right?
is happening here?
Right. Except Mehmet, like, as he was being led in for questioning, he's cuffed, the cops, he didn't, like, make his statement to the police. I mean, he did, but he was speaking to the cameras as he was being led in the building. I didn't do this. This has nothing to do with me.
Yes.
I'm with the Vatican. Bro, you tried to kill the Pope a year ago.
Right, like,
but, well, 2 years ago,
buddy, at this point. People.
Because the Grey Wolves told you to, but now you're saying it's the Bulgarians and the KGB?
Right? Like, what is going on?
I don't fucking know.
No.
And it's going to get weirder. That I do know.
Same.
That I do know. And I do know who those bodies belong to, but we will get there.
Indeed, we shall.
Next week.
Yes, indeed, to that.
And.
Herpy derpy.
It will get.
Derpy derp.
Weirder. I'm sorry if your brain hurts. Mine does. Yeah. My brain hurted writing it and watching it and listening to the recordings and going to sources. It's like, nope, that is in Italian. I have not the time. So
that is one reason why it is still on my list, because I was like, that's too many things happening right now.
And I made the epic fuck up.
Uh-oh.
I was like, okay, well, I'll try to pick an easy one because I know the Patreon's going to be sooner.
So many times.
And then as I start
going. Have I cursed myself with that very thought.
I'm like, oh, fuck. But you've already started, so there's nothing you can do.
Mm-hmm.
I'm balls deep in the story now.
Yep.
Like, I can't stop.
No.
So I didn't. And so I'm going to go home now and watch more documentary because apparently this is one of those that you have to.
Yeah.
Everything's in Italian.
Yeah.
But it's a great story, and I've just fucked myself, so that's all right. I'll survive. I'll live.
Was it good?
The story's great. However.
It's not.
No.
It was so.
No.
You regret fucking yourself.
I do. I have no time. I have no time. But this, I like I said, I'm balls deep. I can't stop. Can't stop, won't stop. I've already told you part one. But yeah, as I was writing it, and then I was like, well, it's too late now. I can't go back. So, but yeah, sorry if your brain hurts. That was a lot of information, and it's just going to get weirder next week.
So, it really is.
It really, really is.
Fucking A,
Cotton. Fucking A, Cotton. All right, well.
I believe you have a line to say.
Oh, yeah. Well, y'all know the drill. Rate, review, subscribe.
You're skipping one.
Which one is it? My brain hurts.
We done it.
Oh, we done it, y'all.
We did.
God bless it. I'm telling, this story fucked my brain.
Take a breath. Y'all know the drill. Rate, review, subscribe, share.
There it is.
If you like some exclusive motherfucking content, go become a patron on our Patreon.
Yeah. Till next time, y'all.
Till next time, y'all. Hexes and hoes, y'all.
Hexes and hoes, y'all.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hats off to the Fuck You Club.
I don't know who.
Yeah, y'all. Neither of you really had.
No.
So let's roll through the classics then.
I mean, we can say the Pope John Paul II.
Fuck Catholicism.
Yeah.
fuck the Catholics. Yeah, right?
The Vatican.
If you're a practicing Catholic and you haven't, you're not a practicing Catholic if you're listening to this. Who am I kidding? Fuck the Catholics. If you are and you haven't donated to things that try and, you know, kill people like Dee and I, then cool, I guess. But chances are that's not you.
Well, fuck you, Bob.
Fuck you, Bob.
Always.
Fuck you, Gwyneth.
Fuck you, Gwyneth.
Most
Kimberly
definitely.
Can't read.
Fuck you, Ted.
Fuck definitely you, Ted.
Who's the new one? Kevin?
Juan.
I'm sure there's a Kevin out there who deserves
probably.
To.
Probably. Probably. Most likely.
Deserves a fuck
he
you.
Knows,
so
he knows what he does.
He knows what he does. Fuck you, Kevin.
Whoever. Whichever Kevin you are.
I know the last time I said this, I got yelled at real bad, but Dr. Vendo, whenever you're ready.
Whenever you're ready.
Whenever you're ready.
Dear friend.
I hope this recording, which I will fail to remember when that email eventually does show up, angers you into such a place that you find where I live and come here and
shit in your freezer?
Shit in my freezer.
My, how the freezers have turned.
And I think we have an episode name.
Oh, hooray. Press the button for fuck's sake.
Don't tell me what to do!